This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll spend some time talking about what is arguably the first great human rights movement of the 20th century. In the 1880s, the great powers of Europe were busy laying claim to Africa, and the King of Belgium, Leopold II, decided that if other countries had colonies, he should have one too. He actually tried to buy one without success. Undaunted, he proceeded to carve out a large and mostly unexplored territory around the Congo River. It became his personal colony. It did not belong to Belgium. It was his, and he profited greatly from it, although he never set foot there. For 23 years, the Congo Free State was the world's only colony claimed by one man. All of the story is told in a widely acclaimed book. It's titled King Leopold's Ghost, and here in the studio with us this morning, the author of the book, Adam Hochschild. He's visiting the campus. He's going to be giving a talk on this subject as a part of the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. These programs are always free and open to the public. Anybody who's interested certainly should feel welcome to attend. If you're interested in the book, by the way, it continues to be available in bookstores. It's out now out in a paperback edition. It has gotten a lot of positive attention. Just to mention a few things, it was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and many different organizations named it a notable book of the year, including New York Times, Boston Globe, Library Journal, Publishers Weekly. Adam Hochschild has written for a number of publications, including The New Yorker, Harper's, New York Review of Books, New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, has been a commentator for All Things Considered on National Public Radio, spent some time now teaching writing at UC Berkeley, and we're glad to have him here in the studio with us. Questions, comments, of course, are welcome, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much.
Good to be here.
Leopold, he wanted a colony. He actually tried to buy one. How exactly does one do that, buy a colony?
Well, it was a little easier to do in the 19th century than it would be today. But I think we should first talk a little bit about King Leopold as a person, because he was a very strange guy. He took the throne of Belgium in 1865 when he was 30 years old. And from the very beginning, he was very frustrated to be king of such a small country. And he repeatedly said so in public. He was also frustrated to be a king at a time in history when it wasn't so much fun to be a king anymore, because you had democracy and parliaments and all this kind of nonsense that kings and queens in earlier days didn't have to worry about. And I think it's that made him so desirous of getting a colony where he could rule supreme without any interference from voters or anything like this. So he tried to buy the Philippines from Spain. He tried to lease land in Formosa and Argentina and Egypt. He actually bought some land in China and built a railway there, which he made quite a bit of money from. Made many attempts to get a colony all over the world, most of them unsuccessful, until in the late 1870s he managed to get in just at the beginning of this huge European land grab in Africa that began at that time.
After some attempts at trying to buy himself a colony, he apparently realized that he was going to have to get it the old-fashioned way and conquer it, and took an unusual, interesting approach. He knew that it would be unpopular if he went out to conquer his colony. He decided that he would represent this as a humanitarian effort.
Exactly. He was a public relations genius. He could really teach today's American tobacco companies a thing or two about how to do PR. He knew that the great countries of Europe were not going to look in a friendly way on the king of tiny little Belgium getting himself a colony, especially since England, France, Germany were already nosing around in Africa for colonies themselves at that time. So he hired the great explorer, Henry Morton Stanley, the man who found Livingstone, to go back to Africa, work for 5 years as King Leopold's man in Africa, staking out this vast territory with more or less the same boundaries it has today, that we call the Congo. And then he managed to bamboozle Europe and first the United States into thinking that his purposes in acquiring this territory were purely humanitarian, philanthropic. He was bringing civilization and Christianity to the poor, benighted natives there. In no way expected to make money from this, but that they should recognize this territory as belonging to him, or as the phrase usually was in those days, as being under his personal protection. Mm-hmm. And the United States, to our everlasting shame, was the first country to recognize this territory as belonging to King Leopold, a brilliant stroke of Washington lobbying that he pulled off. Once that precedent was established, then all the major countries of Europe fell into line and recognized it also as his possession.
Mm-hmm. That's particularly, a little bit unsettling when you think that it was the United States that opened the door to this and made this possible.
It really was, and it's fascinating how Leopold pulled this off. He had a friend, a man named Henry Shelton Sanford, who was a former American ambassador to Belgium. He'd been appointed ambassador to Belgium by Abraham Lincoln, in fact, then stayed on in Belgium, liked royalty, liked living in Europe, became a friend of King Leopold. And in 1883, Leopold sent Sanford to Washington as his personal lobbyist. It was a brilliant choice because Sanford was very well connected with the upper circles of the Republican Party that was then in power. Sanford also had business interests and land all over the United States, a very wealthy man. And as it happened, the president of the United States had a few months previously spent his spring vacation on an orange plantation in Florida that Sanford owned. The president of the United States at that time was a man named Chester A. Arthur, somebody who, by comparison with him, George W. Bush is a great intellectual. This total nonentity of a man, President Arthur. So there shows up in Washington at the White House a fellow who's representing King Leopold. Arthur owes him a favor because Arthur spent his vacation at Sanford's orange plantation 6 months earlier. Sanford actually wrote language for a presidential speech that Arthur gave a few days later to Congress, praising the great philanthropic work that King Leopold of the Belgians was doing in the Congo. And some 6 months later, after a lot more lobbying by Sanford in Washington, under the table payments to editors of newspapers and so forth to write favorable articles, the Secretary of State recognized this vast territory as belonging personally to King Leopold of Belgium. And for the next 23 years, Leopold proceeded to exploit it in the single most brutal episode of European colonialism in Africa.
Just to introduce our guest again, who, for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here, we're speaking with journalist Adam Hochschild. And this story is told in his book, King Leopold's Ghost, the subtitle, A Story of Greed, Terror, and Heroism in Colonial Africa. It is available in a paperback edition, so if you'd like to read the book, it is in the bookstore. He's also here visiting the campus, and we'll talk about it later on this afternoon, and I'll give you that information again later. And questions are welcome, too. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. One of the things I think that is fascinating about the book is the kind of information, the background, the story should tell about the characters in it, people that may indeed be familiar names, like Stanley. Everybody knows about the Dr. Livingstone sort of story. Mm-hmm. And yet I think probably a lot of the public image of Stanley doesn't square up very well with what this man was really like. What sort of a fellow was Henry Morton Stanley?
Well, he was unquestionably a great, great explorer. There's no doubt about that. You have to hand it to him. He made these epical crossings of Africa, found all sorts of, you know, rivers, mountains, rainforests that Europeans had never seen before. But he was a very brutal man. And for him, the act of exploration was intimately connected with that of conquest. He traveled heavily armed, shot down anybody who was in his way, floated down the Congo River on canoes, shooting at people on both sides if they challenged him in any way. And, of course, he thought Africa was there for the taking. And in his descriptions of the African landscape and the flora and the fauna and so forth, some of which are extremely precise, careful, you know, really scientifically rigorous, he describes this place almost as if it were a continent without people. He's looking at what the natural resources were, what the sources of wealth for Europeans could be, because he lived and very much exemplified this age when, in the late 19th century, Europe had all the confidence of the burgeoning Industrial Revolution and felt the world was there to be taken. And Africa, the place that seemed most empty, was there to be taken by Europe. And they ignored the fact that there were millions of people living in Africa. They took them, too.
And the Congo just, it seemed to be a perfect, you know, it was the proverbial plum that was just waiting to be picked. It had a good system of waterways that could be used for transportation. It had great resources. And the Europeans knew that with the force of arms, men and arms that they could bring to bear, that the indigenous people, that there was simply no way that they were going to stand up to them. They could simply, and they did indeed. They just simply said, either you do what we want or we'll just kill you.
Well, this has been the case in all of the great conquests of history. The people who come in and do the conquering usually have much superior armaments. And it was true, you know, when the Europeans arrived in the New World, they had muskets. The indigenous Native Americans didn't have any kind of firepower like that. By the late 19th century, many Africans actually had muskets, which were still floating around from the days of the slave trade, where slave traders had used these as items of trade a lot. But the Europeans had repeating rifles, they had machine guns, they had small cannon, they had the steamboat, which made them very mobile because, as you said, the Congo in particular had this network of navigable waterways. So for King Leopold, it was like conquering a territory that had a built-in railway network.
What did they do, and how did they proceed in taking this place?
Well, the core of what they did was this, and it was spurred by something that happened in Europe in the late 1880s, namely the invention of the inflatable bicycle tire. As soon as that was invented, followed very quickly, of course, by the invention of the automobile, that set off a worldwide demand for rubber. People in North America and Europe simply could not get enough rubber to make bicycle tires, automobile tires, insulation for electrical wiring, all sorts of other industrial uses. As soon as the rubber boom began, which was in the early 1890s, people in tropical territories throughout the world frantically began planting plantations of rubber trees. But a plantation of rubber trees may take up to 15 years to come to maturity to get to the point where you can begin tapping the rubber out of the trees. And in the meantime, the people who could really make fortunes were people who had land that had wild rubber. And the great equatorial rainforest of Central Africa was extremely rich in wild rubber, which comes not in trees but in vines. And King Leopold had vastly more of this forest than anybody else. So, to put it simply, what he did was he had organized a private army, 19,000 officers and men, black conscript troops under white officers. They would send them into village after village. The soldiers would hold the women of the village hostage in order to force the men of the village to go into the rainforest, scattering quite widely for days and sometimes weeks out of each month to gather a monthly quota of wild rubber. As the price of rubber soared, that quota increased. The men had to travel farther distances, stay away from home longer to get this rubber. And you can imagine the consequences. Many of the women hostages starved. A lot of the male rubber workers were, in effect, slave laborers who were worked to death. And when you have, you know, community after community where the women are held prisoner, and you can actually see pictures of them in chains, and I'll be showing some of those slides when I talk this afternoon, slides of these photos, you know, where you got the women in chains, the able-bodied men working as slave laborers in the forest. That means there's nobody to plant and harvest crops, to go hunting, to go fishing, to do all the things that a community has to do to feed itself. And this system went on for 15 or 20 years, and the results were devastating. Demographers today estimate that between about 1880 and about 1920, the population of the Congo was roughly slashed in half, cut from 20 million people approximately at the beginning of that period to around 10 million people at the end of that period. An absolutely vast holocaust, which today we have largely forgotten about. The Congolese have not forgotten about it, but the rest of the world has.
Yeah. There's apparently an interesting story about how it is that you first learned about this. The story I'd read was that you were reading something by Twain, and that he or you came across a quote from Twain making a reference to this, to the fact that there was this very large international anti-slavery movement, and it had to do with the fact that there was the slave labor being employed in the Congo. And you said, why haven't I ever heard of this?
Exactly. Why didn't I know about this? Here I was, you know, I've been a journalist all my life. I think of human rights as being my specialty. I've been to Africa half a dozen times, mostly to write magazine articles and to do one book on South Africa. I had known that the European scramble for Africa was a very bloody business. But this many people dead in one territory, that was a story I didn't know. And so I started to do some reading, and I began where one begins in these kinds of things, which is general histories of Africa, encyclopedias, and where you can find, on the rare occasions where you can find somebody giving a death toll for the Congo in this period, it's always 8 million people, 10 million people. There's a new book that says 13 million people. An extremely well-known book, Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, which many people were assigned in college, mentions this episode and uses a death toll of 12 million people. She, too, mentions it only in a footnote. So I thought, why were all these people killed? What happened? And why isn't this something that looms much larger in the consciousness of the history of the world? And that's what set me beginning this 3 years of writing and research.
Hmm. Well, how does one answer a question like that? Why is it that an event like this, when so many people died, has, until you wrote King Leopold's Ghost, was largely, by a lot of people, certainly, as you say, people in the Congo remember, and people in Belgium no doubt remember, although they may have their own way of looking at it. Why is it that it was largely forgotten?
Well, I think here's what happened. First of all, it was not ignored while it was going on. During the first decade of the 20th century, due to the efforts of an extraordinary, dedicated, wonderful, small group of people, British, American, African, Irish, human rights activists who cared passionately about this tremendous Holocaust, it was brought to the world's attention. And from 1900 to 1910, it was the number one human rights scandal in the world, in people's consciousness. Much in the way that, say, apartheid in South Africa was during the 1970s and 1980s. Everybody knew the basic facts of apartheid. Well, I tell you, most of what's in my book was known by a careful reader of British newspapers in the decade 1900 to 1910. Then it dropped off the radar screen, and I tell you why. I think what happened was that even though people at that time had been very well aware that there was this vast catastrophe in Africa and there was a lot of protest against it, suddenly there came along in the 20th century four or five great catastrophes whose victims were primarily Europeans and to a lesser extent Americans. World War I, World War II, Nazism, Soviet Communism, and the Great Depression. And these in Western consciousness just sort of supplanted this the memory of this horror show that had happened in Africa around the turn of the century. As far as Belgium and the Congo were concerned, and we should keep in mind that the European conquest of Africa was equally brutal in many, many other places as well. As far as Belgium and the Congo was concerned, it especially got forgotten with particular rapidity, because when World War I began, Belgium was a victim. and all of British and American war propaganda, which was designed to whip up fervor for a war in which Britain and the United States had not been attacked, was based on coming to the aid of poor, innocent, neutral little Belgium, which had been invaded by the big bad Germans, which had in fact been the case, and Belgian civilians had been shot, and, you know, Belgium really was a victim of Germans during that period. But that made it very inconvenient to recall all of the crimes that Belgians had been charged with just a few years earlier.
We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest is journalist Adam Hochschild. His book, King Leopold's Ghost, is available in paper in the bookstore if you want to read it, and it's a great story. Also, if you're interested and you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, he'll be talking about this, King Leopold and the Conquest of the Congo, as part of the MillerCom series. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center. And anyone who is interested is welcome to attend. It's, as all these, as is the case with all these events, they're free and open to the public, and you should see, you should feel welcome. And questions are welcome, too. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One very important figure in the movement to publicize what was going on in the Congo was a British man who worked for a shipping company in Britain. And you tell the story of the fact that he goes to Belgium, the places where the ships are coming from the Congo. He sees the ships coming from the Congo, and they are loaded with ivory and with rubber. And then he sees the ships that are going the other way, and they are loaded with guns and soldiers. Many other people, no doubt, saw the same sight and just went on about their business. But this man, Edmund Morel, he didn't.
Right. To his eternal credit, he didn't. He saw, as you said, the ships coming in filled with ivory and rubber, saw them going out full of soldiers' firearms and ammunition, and he realized there's no trade going on here. Nothing is being exchanged for this ivory and rubber. There's no merchandise being sent to Africa of equal value. And standing at the dockside in Antwerp, Belgium, this 25-year-old junior official of a shipping line realized, I am looking at evidence of slave labor going on 6,000 miles away. And his first action was he went to the head of the British shipping line, which had the monopoly on this traffic, and he said, there's something terrible going on here. I don't know fully how the system works, but there's clearly slave labor at the core of it. We shouldn't be involved with this. The head of the shipping line told him to get lost. When that didn't work, he tried to promote Morel to another job in another country. That didn't work. Then he tried to pay Morel some money to shut up. That didn't work. Morel quit his job, and in the space of the next 3 or 4 years, he turned himself into the great British investigative journalist of his time. He devoted himself 12, 14 hours a day for the next 10 years to putting the story of King Leopold's Congo and its slave labor system on the world's front pages, and he really succeeded in doing that.
Well, we have several callers to talk with. Let's do that. And again, I'll just have to remind people that we're now in our last about 20, 25 minutes, and it will help us if you can be brief, but certainly I'd welcome anybody to call. First off is Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I wonder if your guest might talk about the parallels between what happened the late 19th and early 20th centuries that happened in Peru and Central and South America under the Spanish, you know, probably 300 years before that, and all the parallels that went on, you know, extracting everything out of the country and nothing going back from Europe. And not, I read a book by, I can't remember the author, but it was called The Conquest of Peru, and the same things that your guest is commenting about that happened in Africa had gone on there, you know, all the way from Mexico clear through to the Incas. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, you're absolutely right. There are many, many parallels. Conquest all over the world whenever it's happened, and unfortunately human history seems to be composed almost entirely of peoples conquering each other. is never a pretty business. People always say that they're doing it in the name of civilization and Christianity, or civilization and Islam, or civilization and the victory of the proletariat, or whatever. But when one country or people conquers another, they're usually after some material goods, and they usually find them and take them. There's an interesting connection between Peru and the Congo, which is this. As it happens, part of the conquest that was going on in Peru and the adjacent parts of the Amazon River Basin in the late 19th century also were spurred by this enormous boom for rubber, also involved turning the local population into slave laborers to gather this rubber. A man whom we've not talked about yet, but who's a very important figure in the Congo story, named Roger Casement, an Irishman, played a very important role in writing crucial, well-documented reports for the British Foreign Office, first about the slave labor system in the Congo, and then about the similar slave labor system for gathering wild rubber in Peru and Colombia. Both extremely important documents for putting this information on the public record. Interestingly, while he was doing this work for the British Foreign Office, Roger Casement, who, as I said, was an Irishman — Ireland at that time was part of England, part of the British Empire — for the first time in his life began thinking, hey, wait a minute, Ireland is a colony also. It also was conquered. Its natural resources also were plundered. And after some years in the British Foreign Service, Casement resigned, went back to Ireland in 1913, threw himself into the Irish independence movement, and in 1916 was hanged by his former employers, the British government, and today is regarded as one of the great Irish patriots. But he was first politicized, he was first radicalized, he first began to think about colonialism when he encountered it in the Congo.
We have another caller in Charleston. This is line four. Hello.
Yes. I'm thinking of some of the things that go on in the world today. I guess right now I'm thinking of Tibet, but I'm wondering if your guest could draw some, and I realize they'll be hypothetical, but lessons we might learn from all of these things he's been talking about that would help us in the years ahead with what we're dealing with. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Again, thank you.
Well, you're asking a very big question. And I think the main lesson that I learn from looking at horrible injustice in the past, which seems to be what I'm attracted to writing about, is that when brave people see it and speak out about it, you can sometimes put things on the record, bring about change, make large numbers of other people aware. We were talking a few minutes ago about E.D. Morrell, this British shipping clerk, who, from what he saw on the docks of Antwerp in Belgium, was able to deduce the existence of a slave labor system in the Congo. And it changed his life. And it changed him as a person. And it put this whole thing on the world's front pages, on its political agenda, in a way that it wasn't before. It didn't bring the whole slave labor system in Africa to a stop. Unfortunately, there were just the profits to be made from rubber were simply too high. But I think all through history, there have been people like that who have perceived the injustice around them and tried to act, tried to do something about it, and it's to them that we owe what progress we have made as a human race.
To next, Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think it's important to point out that Leopold was not a Belgian, but a German. And didn't he have collaborators? Wasn't there a kind of international consortium in this exploitation of the Congo?
Well, there are two questions here. When you say Leopold was not a Belgian but a German, you're thinking of his father, King Leopold I of Belgium, who was indeed German-born. And when the new country of Belgium went shopping around for a king in 1830 when it was founded, and in those days every European country worth its salt was expected to have a king, they found this German prince, Leopold, and he became the first king of Belgium. Leopold II, the man I've been talking about, was in fact Belgian-born in 1835, was Belgium's first native-born king. But you're right that there was a sort of international, that there were international collaborators of many sorts, because Belgium was a small country, and Leopold's colony there, which eventually many years later became the Belgian Congo, was a very, very large colony. During the early years when it was under Leopold's private ownership, roughly half of the army officers, colonial officials, and so forth, who administered this whole apparatus of exploitation, were not Belgians. There were Americans there. There were Austro-Hungarians there. There were Germans. There were French. And you get a very good flavor of all this if you read the great, great novel that comes out of that period, Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, who himself, as a native-born Pole, then a British citizen, worked for 6 months as a steamboat officer on the Congo River, created this very, very memorable figure of Mr. Kurtz, the villain, the ivory-collecting agent deep in the Congo rainforest. And Conrad saw the sort of international character of this exploitation that was going on then. And at one point in the novel, uses the phrase, all of Europe went into the making of Mr. Kurtz.
Did that get at your question, Connor?
Yes, I had one more thing to say. Didn't the Belgian government at one point step in and try to straighten this mess out?
Well, what happened was this. Leopold owned the Congo as his personal, privately owned colony for 23 years. By the end of that period, this international protest movement against the atrocities there had created such a furor that many countries, the United States and England in particular, were leaning hard on the Belgian government to reform things by taking this colony away from Leopold and making it the Belgian Congo. And they and the reformers, the people who were protesting the atrocities, hoped, although some of the reformers suspected that it would not be so easy, that once it became the Belgian colony, Belgian Congo, the atrocities would stop, things would be more under the rule of law, it would not be so murderous, and so forth. King Leopold, of course, owned it outright, recognized as such by all the major nations of the world, said to Belgium, okay, if you want my Congo, I'll give it to you, but you're going to have to buy it from me. And so he sold the Congo to Belgium in installments, and the payments were to continue for many years. And that's how it became the Belgian Congo. Unfortunately, the atrocities, the slave labor system, did not immediately stop, because the price of rubber was so high that there was still so much money to be made from this system that it continued basically as it had been, with many of the same officials in place. It really began to moderate and become significantly less murderous around 1920, when the Belgian colonial officials who were running the place then saw that the population was dropping so drastically as a result of this forced labor system that they realized that if they continued things unchanged, that they would have no labor force left several decades down the road. And you can actually find them saying this on paper, amazingly. That's the point at which the system became much, much less murderous and more orderly.
I want to, just for a minute, to return to Joseph Conrad. This is another really fascinating aspect of the story that you tell. Countless, who knows how many, high school, university students have read Heart of Darkness. And it seems always to have been represented as Conrad's attempt to tell a story about the dark side of human nature. Not that it was supposed to be so much about the Congo, but that it was these larger themes and that essentially Conrad made it up. What you have argued based on your research is, in fact, no, he didn't make it up. It was based on what he saw and what he heard. And in fact, there were real people who were the basis of this character, Kurtz. There were real Kurtzes in the Congo.
Exactly. I mean, critics always talk about Heart of Darkness as if it's about the darkness in us all, which it is. But like many great works of literature, it's true not only on a figurative level, but on a very literal level. And everything in that book is literally true. Everything in that book is based on things that Conrad saw, heard about, or on people he met while he was in the Congo. And I began to realize this when, because like everyone who's read Heart of Darkness or seen the movie Apocalypse Now, which is based on its plot, you remember the severed heads that Mr. Kurtz has on fence posts outside his house deep in the jungle. And critics talk about what does this symbolize and from what part of Conrad's imagination did this image come and so forth. Well, after I'd been researching this period for a couple of years, I'd come across records of no less than 4 white men in the Congo at that time who boasted about collecting severed African heads. 3 of them, we know, are people whom Conrad met or heard about. 2 of them are people whose photographs I've been able to get, and I'll include them in my slideshow this afternoon. So Mr. Kurtz was very much based on real people, a combination of several real people.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have other callers. Our guest, Adam Hochschild, his book is King Leopold's Ghost. He's talking about this on the U of I campus this afternoon. It's part of the MillerCom series, 4 o'clock at the Levis Center. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you should feel welcome to attend. We have other callers here, and we'll go next to someone in Indianapolis, line 3. Hello. Well, I guess they changed their mind. How about, this is Belgium, but it's Belgium, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Yes, just named after the country, not named after the people or anything like that. the question I have, and I, you know, maybe you were able to ascertain this or maybe not, you keep talking about this enormous fortune that was made from the rubber, and obviously he probably didn't sell the colony for a cheap price. What happened to this enormous amount of money?
Well, some of it you can actually see if you go to Belgium today. In Brussels, there is this gigantic thing called the Arcade du Cinquantenaire, which is a sort of triumphal archway that looks like a swollen combination of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris and the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. This was built with Congo money. The royal palace at Laeken outside of Brussels, where the Belgian royal family still lives, was expanded enormously with Congo money. Congo money built at the Palace of Laeken the world's largest privately owned collection of greenhouses, one of which is still filled with palm trees from Central Africa today. Leopold used some of this money to buy a castle outside Paris for his 16-year-old girlfriend. He built a gallery at his favorite racetrack. And when he died, he tried as best he could to take it with him by setting up a series of secret foundations in Belgium, England, and France in which this money was left, what was left over at that point, with specific instructions on what it was to be used for. This, of course, became very complicated because he died only 5 years before the First World War, during which Germany invaded Belgium. France and Germany were at war, and it took his successors many, many years before they could get the finances completely untangled and figure out where this money all was. it unfortunately all ended up, what had not been spent on building projects in that point and so forth, had all ended up in the coffers of the Belgian government. And there was no thought ever given to returning it to the Congolese, the people whom it had been taken from.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Just a couple of moments ago, you also told the story, the fact that eventually there was so much fuss about the Congo that the government of Belgium bought it from Leopold. I think this was 1908.
Yes.
But what's also it needs to be said is that the Belgians didn't actually pay for it themselves. They didn't put a tax on the Belgian people. It didn't come out of the Belgian coffers. The money actually came out of the Congo.
Right. Right. You know, taxes and so forth were levied there, which were then to be paid to Leopold. So once again, in yet another way, the people of that poor, you know, country were exploited financially yet again. And I think it is really the terrible suffering and depredations of this period, which is one of the major reasons why the country is having such a hard time functioning today. And perhaps we should mention that over the next 2 days here at the University of Illinois, there's going to be a conference devoted to talking about this. People are coming here from Africa, from Europe, from other parts of the United States, a lot of Congolese intellectuals who are gathering here Friday and Saturday primarily, and a lot of the sessions are open to the public to discuss what can be done to heal this deeply wounded country today.
Hmm. The book has been published in Belgium, and I gather that it's sold well. A lot of people in Belgium have read it. What do Belgians think about this story and what you have written about it?
Well, this was quite fascinating for me because, you know, we give the Germans and the Japanese a hard time for not coming to terms with what they did during World War II, the Japanese especially, and so on. But this is nothing compared to Belgian ignorance of what went on in King Leopold's Congo. It is absent from Belgian school books. The story is not there. Even well-educated Belgians know very little about this. The book was translated into French and Dutch, the two languages of Belgium, and I went there on my book tour. The journalists who interviewed me on radio programs like this and so forth were all, people who were concerned about human rights and were rather embarrassed that they didn't know the history, and they were, you know, very friendly, and they said, well, you seem to have all the footnotes and the sources and so forth, but we just didn't learn about this in school. Most interesting was the attacks from the old colonials, because there were roughly 60 or 70,000 Belgians living in the Congo when it rather abruptly gained independence in 1960. Almost all of them came home. They're very well organized into fraternal associations of former police officers and former army officers and so forth. And they were enraged by this book. And about 4 months after it was published, they opened up a website on the internet. The longest single item on which was an 8 or 9 page diatribe against the book, and the longest thing anybody's ever written about me anywhere. And I was thrilled because it meant more publicity. It sort of put this more in the public realm. And they said, Hochschild doesn't give credit to, you know, the good things King Leopold did, the building the railroads and the steamboats, and he did build the railroads and the steamboats in order to ship the rubber out more fast, you know, in a faster way to Europe. They said, furthermore, what right does an American have to write this book after what happened to the American Indians? And it's true. You know, the death rate among American Indians was vastly higher even than the death rate in the European colonization of Africa. But one writes not as an American criticizing Belgians, but as somebody who cares about human rights, hoping that such violations will never take place anywhere in the world ever again.
Mm. Well, it is notable that the people who were very much involved in trying to organize, orchestrate this international campaign, I mean, back at the time when this was still mm-hmm. Leopold's colony, were notable that the people who were involved in that were American and British. Certainly the record of America and Britain, as far as indigenous peoples goes, was less than spotless.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the death rate among Native Americans in this country was probably well over 90%. I'm not sure anybody knows what it is, but it was way up in that range. You know, when Britain conquered Australia and Tasmania, there were extermination orders issued against the Aborigines. You know, these were countries that did not have clean hands. And the other European countries that were colonizing parts of Africa that had wild rubber in them, in this great equatorial rainforest that had a lot of wild rubber in it, France, Germany, Portugal, in their rubber-bearing areas, the death rate was also around 50%, the way it was in King Leopold's Congo. Because they looked at him, they saw how profitable was this slave labor system he'd developed, and they developed the same thing.
Mm-hmm. We have to finish. I'm struck by that earlier caller who talked about what lessons there are to be drawn. And it seems to be one big one, the most important one, the fact that still in the world today we are dealing with the legacy of colonialism, and we forget that at our peril, because the people in the countries that were colonies, they haven't forgotten.
They sure have not.
Well, I much appreciate you being here and taking some of your time to talk about the book, because I think it's a really remarkable story. At 10 different publishers turned this down before you found someone to publish it.
Isn't that amazing? I wrote a book proposal explaining what I was going to say in this book and why I thought it was an important story, and I had a track record. I'd published several other books which had gotten good reviews and won minor awards and so forth. The proposal went to 10 New York publishers, and 9 of them turned it down. They said, oh, no market for books in African history. Good story, but why don't you do it as a magazine article first? I like the story, but I could never get it through the higher ups at this publishing house. But happily, all a writer needs is one publisher, and Houghton Mifflin in this country immediately saw that this was an important story, and they've been wonderful to work with, and it's now been published in 10 other countries as well.
Well, again, the book is King Leopold's Ghost by Adam Hochschild. It's in the bookstores if you want to read it. It's a good story. And also, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, he'll be talking about it as part of the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock. This is in the at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. Anybody's welcome to attend. Again, thanks very much.
It's been good to be here.